Hi everyone, it's Daniel here. We're delighted to be going out as part of PWO PTBN's pilot podcast season. But before we begin the podcast, I'd just like to say, if you are interested, you can find us on Facebook at Puro Puri, and you can also find us on Twitter at Puro Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show.
Episode of the Puro Freak podcast. My name's Daniel. We'll just leave it there for various reasons that we might come into later on. And I'm joined by two titans, two leviathans, two behemoths of the sport.
The three pillars of podcasting.
Absolutely. First up there, you just heard his dulcet tones. Mr. David wait, are we going with your full name?
Fuck it.
Aye. This guy just does not give a fuck. David Forrest. And also Mr. George Thompson.
Hello.
As well. Hello, gentlemen. Okay, so just before we get started, I think the first sort of port of duty here is probably to introduce ourselves, let the listeners know a little bit about our background as wrestling fans, how we got into wrestling, that kind of thing. So I'll throw it to you first, David.
Well, I mean, fuck. I remember I started watching wrestling in 99. I vividly remember the first match that I'm sentient about was the I Quit match.
Oh.
Of Rock and Mankind.
Oh yeah.
That was the one. And I remember having a big argument at the time about how my friend didn't believe that Mick Foley had quit, and he said, "No man, it was a recording over the PA," and we had a massive fucking argument in school about this for like a week, and then it turned out I was right. Fuck.
You got anyway, worked.
This, I know, and this continued until about 2004. I think the last thing I seen was JBL versus Eddie Guerrero. That match.
Oh, the one where he bled like a geezer, yeah.
Like yes. The proverbial stuck pig. Yeah.
It was a great American Bash as well, with the Concrete Crypt match.
Oh God.
But I mean, you probably know by now. I love that sort of shit. So yeah. That didn't put me off, but you know, women and like. You know, being in school and heavy metal, it kind of got in the way
after
a while. And then for about 4 years, I didn't do anything to do with wrestling. I had my, like, tapes that I had that I would sometimes watch when I was bored, as you do. Mm-hmm. But I didn't keep up with the current product, apart from one night when I stayed over at a friend's house and we watched Raw. And the build-up to Cyber Sunday 2006. I can't fucking believe I remember that.
All the cybers just roll into one these days, don't they?
Exactly. But it was the one where they had the three champions and a triple threat. Mm. And it was just... And then 2008, I moved in with my girlfriend. And I realised that I was allowed to buy WrestleMania. Because my family would never allow me to buy it. They wouldn't pay for it for me. And then I was like, what the fuck? I'm a grown adult. I can watch WrestleMania. And then... For about 2 years, I just watched WrestleMania, me and my wife, or my girlfriend at the time. And then I was like, I watched the Rumble, so I know who's going to be in WrestleMania for like 26. And then I just kept going, and then this happened.
So we'll come into in a few moments about how we all sort of because what we're actually going to do today for everyone listening, we're going to talk about the first Puro. Are we going with Puro or Puro?
Puro.
Puro. Okay, we'll
Puro
go with
Puro. Wrestler. That's what I call it. Yeah. Japanese wrestling.
Yeah, Japanese wrestling.
The Japanese wrestling for Re podcast doesn't really work as well.
Yeah, no, it doesn't really.
It's not alliterative in the slightest.
No. So yeah, we're going to actually go into a bit more depth about the first matches, the first Japanese matches that we all saw. So we're going to go into that in just a bit. But before we do that, George, give us a little bit of background about yourself.
Okay, well, I remember back in the day, wrestling was real big in the schoolyard at primary school. And it used to be on Channel 4, so everyone used to watch Sunday Night Heat. The pay-per-views would be on, and you'd record them on your VHS.
Until a pensioner got their boobs out and they had to stop it, I think. Is that right?
That was when wrestling peaked, really. Just
put, yeah, they put it on delay, so it was like fucking an hour-long delay with adverts in, so initially fucking 5:45 in the morning.
So basically, the first show I ever saw was 2001 Royal Rumble, which... yeah, it's a great show. I think that possibly the best Rumble match, 1992, be damned. And also, there's loads of other great stuff on the show, like Benoit versus Jericho in a ladder match, Kurt Angle versus Triple H with loads of shenanigans, Edge and Christian versus the Dudley Boys to open the show. This was just early 2001. Wrestling was just absolutely awesome. It was a great run of shows.
I have one abiding memory about the 2001 Royal Rumble. Obviously, it was a great show, but you know, remember on the Honky Tonk Man, famed cunt Honky Tonk Man?
Yes.
Horrendous human being, the Honky Tonk Man.
Jerry Lawler just absolutely lost his mind. Despite the fact that Jerry Lawler fucking hates the Honky Tonk Man. Yeah. And Jerry Lawler singing along to the Honky Tonk Man's theme tune is the fucking funniest thing. I just have him shrieking, "He's the Honky Tonk Man," yeah, and over again.
It's amazing. He can't sing at all either, so like, it's even funnier. No.
You know what? Sorry, just so for those of you to know, one of my big passions outside of Japanese wrestling is U.S. territorial wrestling, and I'm particularly fond of the Memphis territory. So, believe it or not, I think that at one point when Lawler lost a Loser Leaves Town match, possibly against Bill Dundee, he actually the kayfabe reason for him sort of giving everything up was, well, I can't wrestle anymore. Now I'm going to go off and I'm going to become a singer, like, and that was the kayfabe reason in the show for him, sort of for him not coming back or trying to sort of, you know, get his place back. He was like, oh, I'm too busy having a singing career, which was total bullshit. But there's a Memphis curio for you all as well.
That's cool. So yeah, basically, yeah. 2001, I got proper into wrestling with my best mate from school. Not wrestling with my best mate from school, but like watching it. Around about 2003, 2004, we went to some of the live shows. We saw the majesty of Kevin Nash, Scott Steiner tag team on one occasion. It was dog shit. And then about 2006, sort of fell out of the habit. The WWE, which was to all intents and purposes the only wrestling I really knew at the time, was the product wasn't very good, and you know, I got into other interests. I mean, I can't remember what they were. I think it involved playing a lot of video games. I might have done a bit of schoolwork, who knows. And I got back into wrestling in 2011. I think this is the case of quite a few people, actually, when they did the whole CM Punk walking out on the WWE storyline. CM Punk, may he rest in peace.
Oh, God. Bless him.
Oh, poor bloke.
Oh, wee lamb.
Oh, poor Phil with his massive, massive cash payout.
If anyone's listening to this 3 years down the line when CM Punk is like the welterweight champion of UFC, we're going to have dated ourselves, weren't we?
Oh, there'll be egg on our face, that's for sure.
Was it the evolution of Punk where they like shot them on Christmas Eve? I can't imagine. But imagine being that fucking Christmas, that camera crew go, by the way, you can't spend Christmas with your fucking family. You go to Chicago and spend it with Phil and AJ as they sit and watch telly.
You've got to watch Phil get tapped over and over and over and over again by white belts in fucking Rufo Sport on their shitty 0-1 yellow coloured mats.
Oh dear. The poor bloke.
Even getting to 0-1.
No chance. Not being that bad at grappling.
But yeah, so then I... Well, we'll get into Japanese wrestling in a moment, but my fandom grew and grew from sort of getting back into WWE again, remembering just how much damn fun I had watching wrestling when I was a teenager. At the end of the day, it might have had something to do with the fact I was doing a postgrad degree and sort of wanted to retreat back into my sort of infantilized self when everything wasn't so hard and you could afford to piss away endless hours of your life watching wrestling. And now here I am pissing away endless hours of my life watching wrestling.
Right then, it only leaves myself. Yeah, so
Like at the Harvest theme?
No, just Last of the Summer Wine will do, mate. Like, so, yes, when I were a lad, I was about actually 5 or 6 years old, I think, when I first got into wrestling. And it was entirely through to a strange combination of early onset body dysmorphia and I think having to go and stay with my auntie who lived down south, and I went to stay with her a bit, and it actually turned out later on that she was quite the racist, and she's been excommunicated from the family altogether. But anyway, that's besides the point. She took me to a video shop, and I was just meant to pick a video to sort of keep me, you know, entertained when I got in. And I saw a picture of the British Bulldog, Davey Boy Smith, on one of these videos. You know when he had like the sort of the culturally insensitive braids in his hair and that. And I saw that and I thought, fuck me, this lad looks enormous. He looks like he's a superhero from a comic book. And I asked her to get it out for me. And I watched that probably about 5 times in a row that day. And I fell in love with wrestling from there. The problem was that as people of sort of modest backgrounds or whatever, we didn't have Sky. So really, when you were growing up in Britain, you had to have Sky to sort of see all the sort of WWF stuff. We'd get a WCW show on ITV now and again, a sort of quite poor quality one, or the one that probably I'd quite enjoy now. Yeah, that was the sort of childhood bit. Loved it all the way through up to the Attitude Era, where obviously everyone else got on the bandwagon. And around that time, I started getting deeper into wrestling and getting into ECW and tape trading with sort of strange men with funny pseudonyms from Portland who'd send you things in paper bags.
That's very like 90s Tory. That's retro, that is.
yeah, no, totally. I started doing that, and luckily there was actually a wrestling shop, which I'll talk more about later, but there was a wrestling shop in Manchester that I discovered, and he would sell pirated, bootlegged sort of tapes that he'd just taped off DVDs or whatever for about £6 a pop. And the first Japanese wrestling I ever saw was just on his recommendation. He said, "You need to watch this tape, it's fucking amazing." And that'll bring us to the first match I ever saw, which we'll talk about in a moment. Now I am still wrestling obsessed. I'm 30 years of age. And I started a Facebook group where I could chat to me mates about wrestling, and that's how we all sort of got the idea of doing this podcast.
Yeah,
I mean,
myself and you, Daniel, we met in person. We'll go into the story. We met in person at an indie wrestling show in Bethnal Green in London in 2014.
It was Rev Pro.
Yeah, Revolution Pro Wrestling, like one of the big shows at York Hall. Always a fantastic time. And it was the first indie show my girlfriend and I have seen together, and I basically sold it to her, like, these are all these amazing wrestlers you've heard of, but the big selling point really was Rikishi, Scotty Too Hotty, and Grandmaster Sexay being on the show.
Bear in mind, Jushin Liger not on this card as well?
No, Liger wasn't, but, like, Kazuchika Okada was.
Oh, Okada was, though, yes.
How many drinks deep were you at this point?
Oh,
a lot.
To explain... I'd been at the London Anarchist Book Fair that day, which if you're someone of my political persuasions and a raging domestic extremist, that's Anarchist Christmas, basically. Everyone gets very excited about it. But also what tends to happen is about halfway through the day, you find a group of people that are putting on a talk, and you've got a very kind of small sort of disagreement with them, and it gets you really angry, so you decide that you're going to split, and you go to a pub, and I was getting drunk from about probably 12 o'clock in the afternoon, to be honest. And I turned up at the York Hall after being in the pub with some other mates beforehand. And I feel really bad now that George just said that he doesn't like speaking to people who he doesn't know, because I was probably the last person on the list he wanted to speak to, because I was fucking steaming by that point. I mean, honestly, George, what was I like at the last match?
Basically... You were the most enthusiastic man I've ever seen at a live event, and it's amazing because you can go to the RevPro website and watch the show on demand, and Daniel is right on the hard camera, marking out to completely everything. It was fantastic, but you know how it is
What was the final match?
Will Ospreay versus Matt Sydal.
That's right.
Well, your favourite match in the world.
Hey, when I watch things live, it's different. We'll go into like I guess all of our sort of tastes in a minute. But when I'm watching a live show, I don't really care about like my style biases like that I normally have.
Yeah.
I'll take the piss and I'll say some silly things maybe. But overall, if you give me a great Spotfest live, I'm totally cool with that. It's when I get home and I watch it again and think, fucking hell, I've only like life's too short. I could be watching fucking plodding Harley race matches from the 70s.
but like then, on that occasion, you know when you hit the wall when you get really reeking and you know, you sort of crash, and by the time of the main event, and this is a verbatim quote from Mr. Daniel, said, "I can't deal with psychology. I just want to do a load of flips so I can go home."
Yep, that was pretty much it. I was like, Osprey, Seidel, I know what we're here
you
for.
You know what? You demanded flips with no psychology, and by God, you got it.
Yes, I did.
By the battle lord.
Although by the end of it, I think I was literally about to fall asleep, so I had to sort of run off before there was the big angle at the end. But yeah, that's how me and George met as well. So yeah, that's an origin story for us. Basically, me and David got in touch primarily because we have a mutual friend, and we share a lot of interests in sort of weird music and stuff like that. David invited me to play a gig, and this is very relevant for this podcast because, David, tell them about the musical project that you invited me to play the gig with.
Yeah, so my musical project is called Abdullah Kobayashi.
Of course.
And yes, and it involves basically two masked people that I don't know fighting. I say I don't know them. It's me and my friend. But but we brawl through the 13th note. It's great fun, and it's so as hell. Don't do it. Just don't fucking do it. But I remember I thought that Dan like this, so I thought I'll invite him, and he went, "Are you named after the cunt that eats glass?" I was like, "Yes." He said, "I'm in. I don't even care what you sound like. I'm in."
It took me another 2 weeks to actually listen to it, I think. I was just like, I know what this is all about. Of course I'm down with this. Like, in a roundabout way, we've all come together through this Facebook group that I run. We're planning on starting a website soon as well. By the time you've heard this podcast, it may well be coming through that website, which is really cool. This podcast is going to be about Japanese wrestling and its discontents.
Jesus.
Sort of shit you have to deal with.
Right, okay, that's
breaking down. How many cans have you got there?
Oh, it's not a can. I don't do cans. I don't have enough money. It's it's a $3.99 bottle of Barnstormer. Now, this is actually mixed with... This is mixed with Asda's own brand orange juice, orange squash.
Classic.
So, yeah, so basically, this is known as a Dan cocktail around the area of Newcastle. That
I will say, this is coming from someone who wants to cook spaghetti with those pasta sheets. I was cooked it and cut my hand, so that I don't know, it was blood and pasta sauce, and I fucking ate it anyway. So I know exactly what you mean. It's just like, I'm way too deep into this at this point. It's all red, it doesn't matter. If it's in me before, it'll go back in me again.
The struggle is real, ladies and gentlemen. If it hasn't gone down the Thames, it's not going in my mouth. Anyway, to the regiment. Right, so what I've got here... So guys, now we're going to talk a little bit about how we actually got into Japanese wrestling. We've done the wider wrestling kind of habit that we picked up. Let's talk about our first experiences of Japanese wrestling. David, to you first.
Well, my recollection of Japanese wrestling back before, I got out and got into heavy metal and girls and like the not this shite basically. I remember I had very vague. There was two reference points. Well, three maybe. You had the Chris Benoit tape with Great Sasuke on it, where I knew he was in the Super J Cup, but had never watched it.
Yeah.
And then you also had Jushin Liger and Ultimo Dragon in WCW, who were, I mean, that was they're and to this day, Liger is still one of my favorites.
Liger's got two contenders for Match of the Year on my Match of the Year ballot at the moment.
Yeah,
like,
he's 51. Yeah. It's ridiculous. Liger's so good that my girlfriend is a huge mark for him. Despite the fact she has barely seen any of his older stuff from the 90s, it's literally based on current New Japan Liger, and he's still in her favourites, and to be honest, he deserves to be.
That's fucking amazing.
Exactly. I mean, the man can have a match with anybody. Literally anybody. If you compare him against any person, he will have a good match. So I knew of Liger, and like, I really, it looked from like Nitro when he'd fight like fucking Silver King or something like that.
Hey, don't diss Silver King.
No, you do not be decepted by his stocky physique.
Seriously.
But so, and then as well as that, there was Taka Michinoku. However, like, Taka, I just knew him as the guy who gets smashed every week and landed in the face at the Rumble. But when I got back into wrestling, in 2010, when I started to watch the Rumble through to WrestleMania, I decided I'm going to go into the IWC. I'm going to become a member of the IWC, and I joined Wrestling Forum.
Hey, look! We've all
it's
got
full of mutants.
We've all got to start somewhere, sweetie. Like, it's okay. Like, don't worry.
And then I remember like. You would immediately have a conversation about anything WWE. Someone would always pipe in going, it's good, but it's not all Japan in the 90s. Fuck off. I give this, they're the most miserable bastards in the world.
Hey, they still exist, by the way, you know.
Do, every so often I'll go on just to, like,
it's
you know
not,
how...
It's not as good as 6394. Yeah, but nothing is, you fucking idiot. Like, stop setting your bar so fucking high, you'll be miserable all the time, you stupid prick. Sorry.
I know, okay, how was your wedding day? It was good.
Not as good
four
as
and a half stars, it wasn't at the Tokyo Dome. speaking of which, I know somebody who's on their fucking honeymoon and they're going to a fucking New Japan show. They're in Tokyo and they're going to fucking New Japan. And I'm raging.
Here's me stuck on Tinder. Fucking hell. Like...
Well, I spent my honeymoon watching Brock Lesnar to break the streak, so I can't say anything. That was my honeymoon.
That's reasonable.
So, like... It is. Yeah, and like, my wife genuinely feared for my life. She thought I was going to jump the barrier and attack Brock Lesnar. But you know that. You know what? We're all emotional. It was a tough time.
We are.
But,
Did you mean did you mean this? That was my honeymoon, sort of. I didn't realise you meant it literally. I thought, you know, when people say, "Oh, that was my Woodstock."
No, that was your literal honeymoon.
That's awesome.
As in, like, we'd always joked that we'd go to WrestleMania one day, and then realised we had like $3,500 in wedding presents, and we're like, I was like, "Well, should we go to WrestleMania?" And my wife was like, "Aye, maybe we should." So then that was it.
I tell you what, David's son, she's a keeper.
She's a you don't know how many Vader All Japan matches she's endured with me over the last couple of weeks.
Endured is not the word. Enjoyed is the word you're looking for, I think, when it comes to Vader, Vader matches.
Although saying that, the person who's on honeymoon at the moment, I'll come to that later because that has a relevance to our talk in a bit. But yeah, so Wrestling Forum, everyone just being pricks, talking about how Misawa Kawada is the best wrestling match of all time. And fuck all compares to it. Punk's shit promo was good, but it didn't have fucking Kawada in it, so it's nothing. And then I remember, was it Senior Lariato put all 16 Misawa Kawada matches up on YouTube?
Yeah, shout out to Senior Lariato, definitely.
Yes. But it was also, at that point, I love my brawls, and it was effort, and they're like, I love my brawls, and it was just finding the most ridiculous shit. I seem to remember I was in an E-Fed at some point.
Ah.
And then they would have like a list of all like the match types you could have, and I was like, these aren't fucking real matches, and you'd obviously Google them and then find it. Oh wait, Japan. Yeah. That's it. So yes, so that is how I found out about Japan.
And so to sort of sum up, because I think this is important, just because like we know you a little bit and your wrestling fandom. What would you say are the sort of the things that sort of get you excited when it comes to Japanese wrestling? Because I know there are some specific things that you're quite into.
I'm unashamedly I like shit wrestling. I love shit wrestling. Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that at all.
There's nothing wrong with that. As long as it's interesting, it has to have a unique selling point. That's what I look for. And with Japan, they have their own unique selling point by the fucking barrel load. So death matches. And just comedy matches as well. It's always just, you know, something unique. It doesn't matter what it is, something unique. And Japan always constantly innovates. Always. It doesn't matter if it's in terms of work rate or violence or just cop jokes or what. Just, you know, anything.
I mean, I think we should probably set our stall out right away in the sense that... I think we should make this fairly sort of well known. I think from the start, because there's no point sort of hiding behind it. I think it's fair to say, and any of you guys can speak up if you disagree with me. I think it's fair to say that what we're going to try and do on this show is try and steer away from this kind of constant obsession that wrestling fans have with Japanese wrestling about everything being about work rate, or the traditionally understood notion of work rate, because I think to varying degrees and perhaps for different reasons and in different contexts, we all kind of think that approach to wrestling is kind of bullshit and outdated now. Am I right?
It's
bollocks.
So we will be talking about BJW fucking main event crazy acid trip Poseidon matches alongside and with the same gravitas probably that we will attach to a Kawada match or a Misawa match, so
with just as much conviction. And you'll know it'll get to the point where when they look at the description and on iTunes and they see what we're reviewing and they'll see some stupid BJW match and they'll rub their hands in glee. They'll be like, right, we're nowhere in for a good in here. We're in for a ride.
Exactly. Okay, cool. George, how about yourself? When did Japanese wrestling first come onto your radar?
Well, David, you said people like Great Sasuke, Ultimo Dragon, Jushin Liger, who were featured reasonably prominently Sasuke wasn't in WCW, but Liger and Ultimo Dragon were. And they were taken reasonably seriously, albeit with the same stereotype of the inscrutable Japanese that seems to pervade in a lot of American wrestling, even now. And mine was somewhat different in that the Japanese wrestlers I knew were not taken seriously whatsoever. We're talking Taka Michinoku and Funaki in Attitude Era WWF. And people like... going forward a bit, here's a name for you, Kenzo Suzuki.
Oh yeah,
yeah, I remember him.
Oh,
with his
That Paul London match, by the way.
Hey, have you not heard the story about who it was meant to be instead of Kenzo?
It was meant to be Tanahashi, wasn't it?
Yes, he's meant to be against Benoit for the World Heavyweight Belt. That was going to be the program, Tanahashi and Benoit.
I did not know that.
Fucking main event program.
Fuck.
Fucking. Yeah, instead we get Kenzo fucking Suzuki.
Yeah, Kenzo Suzuki with his geisha valet, who was actually his wife, and they wanted to call him Hirohito, if you can believe that, when he debuted.
I really can believe that.
Yeah, and probably the one who was...
The Emperor!
Oh, God. Probably the one who was taken the most seriously in terms of how they were presented was probably Yoshihiro Tajiri on SmackDown. And even then, he was the same, a stereotype of the inscrutable Japanese with mystical powers, which means he can spit mist. And so those were really the Japanese wrestlers I knew when I was growing up. Now, there's one important exception to this, which is, we're all British, do we remember the Wrestling Channel?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, the Wrestling Channel, Channel 427 on Sky, I believe, set up by a load of British hardcore wrestling fans. And they bought up loads of tapes from various foreign and indie promotions until the money ran out. God bless that ship and everyone who sailed on it.
I know every time someone mentions that, it just makes me really sad because at the time, I should have fucking, I had a VCR player.
Yeah.
I should have fucking taped everything. Oh, and I just didn't. And I've kind of just watched other things. It was kind of at the tail end of my wrestling fandom.
Yeah, same.
And, oh, it's just now you just realise that. Fuck. I just wish it was still on.
It was. Yeah. It was a goldmine because this is. I mean, I think 2004 thereabouts. This is before YouTube was even set up. You know, if you wanted to, and we'll get into this a bit later. If you wanted to watch Japanese wrestling, you had to, you know, get the old brown paper bag from America, as you said earlier. You know, you couldn't just type in Tanahashi versus Okada into Google and be able to watch a link. It really was a legit goldmine. And so the wrestling I saw was Pro Wrestling Noah on the Wrestling Channel. Mm. Now, we'll go into it a little bit later because my...
What year Noah's this then?
This just is about so 2004, I think, so in the middle of the Kobashi title
reign. Okay, right.
The reason that I haven't chosen anything from Noah as the first Japanese match I watched, even though the first Japanese match I watched was from Noah, is because I haven't a damn clue who I was watching. Back in the time, it could have been
Maybach Taniguchi.
Yeah, it could have been some lower card jobber. It could have been Misawa and Kobashi. Like, who knows? I've got no idea. Yeah. So the match I've chosen is actually the first Japanese match I went out of my way to watch when I got back into wrestling in 2011. That sort of time. So that was really, again, when I got back into wrestling as a mature adult, YouTube being a thing, you can very easily watch wrestling that's somewhat off the radar of the mainstream, even though Japanese wrestling is getting a bit more popular, but it's still niche by comparison to WWE in this country. And so, it really just made me want to look beyond what WWE was offering up at the time. And here we are. I'm here in 2016, 50,000 words into a novel about Rikki Dozan.
Yeah, it's taken this long for us to reveal to you that we actually have someone here who's literally writing a novel about Rikki Dozan, which is pretty fucking cool, really, actually.
So
I'm sure we'll get more updates about George's Rikki Dozan novel as we go on.
Many plugs.
And so many plugs, it's not even funny. Wait till he's got the book out, I've got like another album out, and then David's got some at the hook as well, like on Bandcamp, we'll be fucking bombarding you.
We can do our own adverts, it's going to be good. Like, we don't even have to get KugaLife.com.
That's right, we can do our own adverts, and we'll make some kind of like 90s lower division Doncaster overstyle slush fund out of the money and fucking... Oh yeah, that's another thing. There will be copious references probably throughout this to obscure 90s football, specifically the lower leagues of Britain. So apologies for that as we go along. Well, it's me now, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I really got into Japanese wrestling specifically because, as I mentioned before, there was a shop in Manchester which sold bootlegged wrestling videos. And I'd gotten to the point where the Attitude Era was great. I was watching pretty much all of that, really. Watching WCW as well, even as it sort of began to get really, really kooky. And then beyond that, I essentially went to the shop and said to the guy, look, I'm fed up with this. What else can you show me? He showed me ECW videos. And through ECW videos, which became my number one promotion at that time, like a lot of 15-year-old boys, I think, that were going through that phase, that was all I watched. And I saw Tajiri in there just a few weeks ago, having an incredible match in the Cruiserweight Classic, by the way, and still an amazing worker. And I saw him work and thought, this looks pretty good. And then a few months later, I went in and he handed me a tape that was just called Japan TV. And that was all it was called. It was just Japan TV. And do you remember Long Play?
Oh, yeah.
On VCRs and that, when you could actually press a button. It's fucking magic, this. That would basically make the tape, that if it was recorded on long play, could go double the time. So if you had a 3.5 hour tape, you could get 6-7 hours worth of footage on it. And it was just this thing called Japan TV. And this wrestling shop, it was called Extreme Central in Manchester. It had what we call the Bible that he had behind the counter, which was a laminated book where he'd recorded every single match on every single tape and put his own star rating on it. Not Meltzer's. His own fucking star rating on it. And I was just looking through this Japan TV tape, and it was like 5 stars. I thought, fuck me. And I bought that, and that introduced us to the match I'm going to talk about. Well, introduced me to the match we're going to talk about later on. I got into it through the strange man behind the counter at Extreme Central, who now runs a promotion, actually, in Manchester called HXC.
Oh, is he that dude?
Yeah.
Amazing.
I think it's the same guy. So yeah, and I used to do a lot of my tape trading through him. So eventually I would start buying stuff off like people that would supply him. It's a bit like drugs, this. You know, he'd just give us the direct sort of email for them, and I'd get in touch, and yeah, I used to get sent stuff. So yeah, that pretty much brings us all up to date, I think. So I was thinking that it might be a good idea now to maybe get into talking about our first Puro matches that we saw. On the August running order I have here, George, you are up first. So do you want to tell us about the match that you've that you've chosen as the first one that you saw and that you'd like to talk about?
I shall. So if we remember what David said earlier, that he's sick of people twatting on about 90s All Japan, I'm about to twat about 90s All Japan.
Hey. Hey, as long as it's not all 90s old Japan, we'll be fine. No, don't worry, no. I'll even it out. Don't worry.
Okay, I'm a man of diverse tastes. So,
old Japan and Noah.
Exactly. You read my mind. So
we got both kinds of music, country and western.
So I think just a bit of background information, because I think if anyone's listening to this and You've watched maybe a bit of Japanese wrestling, and you've seen maybe Nakamura and Asuka and Hideo Itami and people like that on WWE, and you're getting confused by names like Riki Dozan and Abdullah Kobayashi and stuff like that being thrown out. I just thought I'd give a sort of potted summary of this the era of All Japan that I'm going to be talking about. The match that I've chosen is one which is so notable amongst hardcore Japanese wrestling fans that it is simply known by its date, 9th of June 1995. It is Mitsuharu Misawa and Kenta Kobashi defending the All Japan World Tag Team Championship against the Holy Demon Army of Toshiaki Kawada and Akira Taue. So basically, one of the reasons that 90s All Japan is so famous is because of something called the King's Road. Basically, what the King's Road was, I guess, half wrestling style and half angle. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's more of a narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so basically,
there's not really angles as such as everything built on. There's not, you know, there's... It continuously goes, so even when something, you know, you've got like a definitive end to something, it still contributes to it afterwards. It's all one weaved...
Yes.
Yeah. Narrative.
I mean, how I would define King's Road would always be similar to that, but the only thing I'd add would be this was probably the most traditionally booked promotion in the world.
Yeah, very conservative.
At that point. All this stuff was stories that were told in the ring.
Yeah.
It was all stuff that was told through matches and psychology. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, so All Japan, just going back to the start of it, was... started by a guy called Shohei Barber, or Giant Barber, as he was commonly known. Dan, you can't see this, but Daniel's doing a little fist pump. He is a big Barber fan, as am I.
Love Barber.
Yeah.
All hail Barber.
Yeah. Solidarity, brother. And 1972, All Japan was established by Giant Barber, who was the main eventer. He won all the belts. He won the major tournaments. But in the mid-80s, he began to take a little bit of a back step in favour of some of the new generation, people who we will come back to later, like Genichiro Tenryu, Jumbo Tsuruta, Riki Choshu. But for whatever reason, in the early 90s, Riki Choshu had gone back to New Japan, Tenryu had formed his own promotion with Blackjack and Hookers, and Jumbo had... he was slowing down a little bit, although still fantastic, but, you know, the wrong side of 40. And in 1992, contracted hepatitis and was never the same again physically. So the idea was that the third generation of All Japan main eventers would be good enough to touch the gods. They were called the Four Heavenly Pillars, or the Four Pillars of Heaven.
That name is still one of the fucking best summations of the importance of four guys to a company ever in wrestling.
Like... Absolutely.
Exactly, yeah.
And the reason, I think one of the reasons I've chosen this match is, well, not just because it was the first Japanese match I sought out of my own volition, which is, of course, the point of this episode of the podcast, but also because it contains the four pillars, Misawa, Kobashi, Kawada, and Taue. Really hitting their stride, because, like you said, David, the King's Road is a narrative. You know, there was a very complex set of callbacks to previous encounters, so this was by no means the first time these two teams had hooked up, quite the opposite. But you know, the narrative really drew on their previous encounters to create this really thrilling build where fans who were in the know and had seen all their previous encounters would recognise the ways in which they were repeating spots, subverting what you would expect, and really building to this sort of quite rich tapestry of professional wrestling. Also, can I just say, you were talking about the Four Pillars of Heaven. Also, is the Holy Demon Army not the best name for a tag team you have ever heard in your life?
Oh, it's the best.
Absolutely.
It's the best.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's no contest. That is the best name for a tag team ever. And, yeah, we can probably come into this later on, but for my money, top two or three greatest tag team of all time, without question.
Absolutely. And in terms of the name, it's up there with other great Japanese wrestling stables such as Stack of Arms and Sternness.
Oh, Sternness.
I think the best thing about the Holy the Holy Demon Army is that, like the best Japanese tag team names, is bombastically awesome, but makes no goddamn sense when you think about it.
No, not really.
Demons aren't holy. Two of them hardly constitute an army. It's kind of like what Voltaire said about the Holy Roman Empire. You know, they're not holy, they're not demons, and they're not an army.
See, I was going to go with a Warhammer analogy, which is significantly less intellectually pleasing. But it was the only thing I could think of, which was the Chaos Army in Warhammer, but that's the level of my critique after a few ciders. So, sorry, carry on, George.
Yeah, no worries. Well, that was really my stuff on the background, so...
One thing you should probably mention, you mentioned about how this kind of went into, like, you know, previous encounters.
Yeah.
Kawada and Misawa.
In
this match, it's just... Yeah, like... Well, we mentioned now that the whole bit Kawada going into this match.
I think it's important for the context of this match, yeah.
So we're
going to probably do a full episode on the Four Pillars at some point. But I think for this match, if in case anyone wants to look it up on YouTube afterwards, to know the story makes it a lot better.
Yeah. So. I mean, Kawada at this point had faced Misawa many times in singles matches, tag matches, six-mans, and never pinned him. Never. And they, that kind of fed into it. And obviously the crowd knew this, as you were saying, knew the crowd who were in the know. They were into this. So whenever there was, you know, a near fall or, you know, they were always biting on it because they thought, you know, is this the time? And I thought it was unbelievable how much that really played into the match and really added to it. It's something that I really appreciated.
Yeah, the crowd heat is absolutely phenomenal for this. So, I mean... I saw this match back in 2012, I think, was when I saw it the first time. And I watched a lot of matches with these wrestlers and between these teams in the interim. But actually, I've only seen this match twice, and the second time was for this podcast. And I'll tell you why. Basically, to give you an analogy, my favourite novel of all time is 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I read this when I was at school, when I was about 16 or 17, and it absolutely blew my mind. And I've not read it since because I'm absolutely terrified that if I go back and read it again, it's not going to be as good. You know, it's not
exactly.
Do that with stuff all the time, by the way. Like, yeah. There's so many albums that I heard that I just never want to go back to because they'll never be the same and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, absolutely.
It's like,
I mean, so
same with like bands. Like when you go to a gig and you see it and it's just the gig, and you're like, you know, you would never, you don't go see them again because you know it'll never be as good as that one.
Yeah,
moment.
What's the point?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean. Well, I mean, I mentioned earlier about how they went to WrestleMania when the streak was ended.
Yeah.
Since then, I have no interest in going to a WWE show.
Yeah, it's peaked.
It's my one WWE show. I mean, that was my first ever show, and I'm like, I don't ever need to go see another one. I've had my moment. Nothing can match that. Yeah. Now, one thing I will say about this, what you were saying about not going back to watch it. Now, as you mentioned before, with like, your first match was Noah, and you can't remember what it was.
Yeah.
I found that I watched a lot of this stuff a good few years ago when I first got into it, and I've forgotten all about it.
Mm.
So I'm re-watching a lot of this stuff pretty much for the first ever time, with added context. So this is like the first time I've seen this in many, many years, and I've totally forgotten everything about it.
Yeah.
So just because it's just a blur of, right, I watch this match, and kind of none of it sank in. But
this is exactly what I was going to say, because I was terrified that I would rewatch this match, and you know, because I've watched a hell of a lot of Japanese wrestling since I watched you know, this my first Japanese match that I actually remember. And like I say, is it going to blow my mind? And I actually have to say, I probably enjoyed it more the second time, if anything, because I knew the context, because I had never seen any of these men before. I didn't know why Misawa's elbows were a big deal. You know, I didn't know what any of their finishing moves were.
Why has Kobashi got his knee taped up?
Well, we'll get to that.
Where did that come
from? I know. But, I mean, where do you want to start?
Well, I think we'll just start with, I've got some observations down here. It sort of follows a chronological narrative throughout the match. So literally my first note just says, not just Kobashi's knee, but his entire left leg is bandaged.
Yeah. And this is my first note is Kobashi bandage leg.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. This is going to be really important. And you can go watch all these matches we're discussing on this episode. You can go on YouTube, such as the wonder of modern technology. And so that's the first thing I noticed. Kobashi's entire left leg is bandaged. The second thing I noticed, Giant Barber is on commentary, and you can tell it's him because he has the deepest voice I have ever heard. It's like that Bush and Paul singing where you can barely hear it, and when you do hear it, like, it makes you want to shit yourself.
Yeah, it's a proper brown note like shit going on. Like,
it sounds like an IRA tip off.
Mate, was no other continuity All Japan.
Yeah. Just imagine him bobbing down the Falls Road in a flat cap. All 6'8" of him.
Actually, my favourite, just digressing for a little bit, my favourite Giant Barber related anecdote is possibly the most Dave Meltzer thing ever written. Was when he wrote in an edition of The Observer, the Japanese baseball almanac lists Giant Barber's height as 6'9½", which is odd because when I met him in person, he looked to be no more than 6'7¾".
Fuck off.
But this is... Right, Meltzer's being picky there, but wasn't it also Meltzer that said, oh, Andre was only about 6'5"? Like, he comes out with some shit sometimes, his Uncle Dave.
No, like, have you ever heard the call of him on, I think it was a phone in a wrestling observer radio, where somebody phoned in asking about what happened to Bret Hart's manager in Springfield that he bought off Mr. Burns?
Yeah.
And Meltzer had never seen the Simpsons.
Yeah.
No, and he's like, I didn't know that Hart had a house in America.
He's never,
like,
seen the Simpsons.
Yeah, and like, what's his name? Alvarez. Was sitting there. You could clearly see, you couldn't hear him, but you could clearly feel the stifled laughter. He was about to just, like, you know, lose himself. But yeah, I don't remember Bret buying a house. He had one in Winnipeg, but not in America.
That's the thing about that's just the mentality. That's the thing about Mad Money Melts. Like, he lives wrestling. He doesn't know anything about, you know, wider pop culture. He's
anything
an amazing
else.
Man. He's got his niche, and my God, he's filled it. So
he really has.
So the match starts. Kawada gets Irish whipped, and rather than going back to the center as you would expect, he just kicks Misawa off the apron. This is the point at which I thought to myself, this is going to be for me. You know, what we're going to get is a slow build, lots of psychology, great heat, people fucking each other up big time. You know what? This is going to be my jam. And
I have a note here. It's about the ninth one down. I'm going to skip to it because Electro just says, Kawada is a massive prick with massive in capital letters.
Yes.
Just the biggest prick of all time.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable.
I mean, you mentioned before about how this match is... there's certainly an inter... This is the great thing about this match. You can look at this match from the perspective of any of the four guys involved, right? And you can see perfect motivation. You can see a perfect story about who in that match they want to fucking target, why they want to do it. And you can read this entire match from Kawada's perspective as being him going, fuck this. I have pushed the limits of sportsmanship to the fucking end. If you have a knee that is fucked up, Kobashi, I will kick the shit out of it. I don't care. I will get in a dig at Misawa when I get that fucking, you know, Irish whip. It's beautiful.
It is fantastic.
And I think at this point, I will just, like, try and throw out my biases here as well, because it's only fair. I'm not going to try and, you know, kid anyone. I think Toshiaki Kawada is the greatest Japanese wrestler of all time. I voted him, I think, number 3 in my PWO poll. Only above him, I think, was Flair and Funk. So I am going to be a total homer for Kawada throughout the rest of this analysis.
Yeah.
On you go.
I mean, I must emphasize that this podcast isn't just going to be us, you know, spooging our collective loins over stuff. But yeah, this match is, I think, particularly.
But 90% of it.
Yeah. Fair enough. So
the other 10% is just football references.
And jokes about the RA. Yeah. So after Misawa is kicked off the apron, he tags into an absolutely deafening pop. Then Kawada just repeats the trick, kicks Kobashi off the apron, who then gets into the ring to sort him out. And I've used the phrase to fuck up quite a lot in these notes. I've got Taue moves out of the way of a Misawa dive, so Kobashi fucks Taue up instead. And Misawa, probably the first big spot of the match, I think, that really caught my eye was Misawa's elbow suicider. The what you call the suicide dive through the ropes that you see in damn near every WWE match nowadays, but also little elbow strike at the end of it. Sadly, Kobashi's standing in front of the camera and he is a big lad, so we miss it. But I'm sure it looked fantastic.
Yeah.
WCW 2000-esque. Yeah. The one thing I think you've glossed over it. I don't know if anyone else noticed this, but right at the start, at the very opening exchange, there was a moment where they go for like the wrist lock, and then Taue kicks Kobashi in the leg.
Yeah.
And the look from Kobashi is if you told him that your favorite series of The Simpsons was season 16.
Oh.
It's unfucking believable. Yeah. And at that moment, I knew this is it. This is the match for me.
Oh,
that
it's just proper filth from that point on.
It really is, and it's all centered around, you know, these real two dynamics. Kawada's never pinned Misawa, and Kobashi's leg is real hurt. You know, you've got kicks from Taue, knee drops from Kawada. We've got a sharpshooter from Taue that makes the rocks look amazing. I mean, I love Taue, but sometimes, you know, Taue's strengths are in the psychology, not the application, I think it's fair to say. Yeah.
And if we ever talk about, for some reason, I don't know why we would, but if we ever talk about John Cena on this show, I will fucking go to bat for the sort of technical application of moves not being as massively important as other things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, Giant Barber, a lot of his stuff looked flat out bad, but he can put a match together.
Oh, it looks terrible, but who cares? He puts a great match together. Fuck it.
Yeah. So,
exactly.
So, yeah, we've got, and then... So one of the things that, and if we ever review something like Kobashi versus Kensuke Sasaki, you'll see this when you watch current New Japan, they do love a good chop exchange. That's something that, and a word that you might hear is Bushido, sort of the honor code or fighting spirit, Tukon in Japanese. You know, basically, to put it in terms for, you know, English people, I'm a reet hard bastard, and I'm going to prove I'm a reet harder bastard than you.
Yeah. That's basically it.
And in this match, Kawada finds the perfect way out of a chop exchange, because you cannot beat Kobashi in a chop exchange. He's known for it. So Kawada decides to hell with this and starts chomping, Jesus Christ, that's a different kind of match. Stomping the shit out of Kobashi's leg. It's utterly brutal. It's actually quite grim to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
he murders that leg. He absolutely just... goes to town. That he's found his purpose in life, and it's destroying Kobashi's leg.
Yeah. I mean, if your only reference point that you've got for sort of working a limb is if you're a wrestling fan who's kind of relatively up on like the past, and you've maybe watched some Arn Anderson matches or something like that. This is a level of Anderson's clinical. Kawada is just fucking unhinged about it. He doesn't care. Like, it stomps. It's there's no twisting grapevines. It's just knees and stomps and fucking
elbows. He's a nasty bastard.
Yeah.
It's amazing. But I think even nastier than Kawada in this match. Now, when we mention Akira Taue, a lot of people say that he's by far the worst of the four pillars. I don't necessarily think that's fair.
No, they're thinking about it the wrong way.
Yeah, I think he's an excellent worker in his own right, but you kind of have to get used to the way he does things. He's incredibly
like
graceless. You know, he used to be a sumo wrestler. He lumbers about a lot, and I really didn't get Taue at first. You know, I didn't take much notice of him the first time I watched this match. I watched some of his stuff. I know one of the things me and you bonded over, Daniel, when we first met was that Taue versus Yuji Nagata match from 2003.
Oh, I love that match.
And yeah I like it too, but I thought when I watched it, you know, most of the good stuff is Nagata. But the thing that I really like about Taue, now that I've come to sort of appreciate what he's about, is his aura of just casual brutality.
Yes!
He will do heinous things to you, and he won't even care, and he'll do it like he's putting absolutely no effort into it just because he exists to cause this kind of destruction. And the example from this match is that Antawi is known for his choke slams. In fact, I think, barring Abraham Lincoln, he's the first person in recorded wrestling history to have got it over as a main move. Tawei choke slams Misawa onto Kobashi's leg.
Oh god!
Right. This is one of the greatest spots in any sort of big time main event match in any territory ever. I don't care what anyone says. The moment that this happens, the whole match goes up another level. And this is the point for me that it goes from being this really great All Japan main event in that vein to being, for my money, you'll get this, people. I'm given to hyperbole, as you've probably noticed. But again, this is I think, the greatest match of all time. And it's because of everything that comes after this bit. It just goes up another level after this.
Yeah, I mean,
I have a note here saying that every single move, every single one that Kawada does to Kobashi is targeting the leg. Every single one. And nowadays you would have, you know, the people targeting the leg. There'll be other moves in between. There'll be like transitions between legwork. Every single one. It's just, there is no remorse. Yeah.
This is why the Revival are so good nowadays in NXT, because yes, they will get a hold of your leg and they will not let go until they have thoroughly wrecked it, until you can't do anything more with it. The other thing I enjoyed about this is that after the spot where Tawei chokeslams Misawa onto Kobashi's leg, Kobashi spends absolutely ages selling it on the outside, really gets over this devastating move. He gets loads more tape on his leg so he looks like, you know, 1/8 of Boris Karloff. And the most brutal thing actually is after, where as soon as he tries to get back in the ring, Kawada kicks him in the face.
Oh no, not Kawada.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Straight in the face.
It's horrendous. No. And even when Kobashi's not in the ring, his leg is getting worked over. At one point, Kawada gives Misawa a powerbomb, one of many powerbombs Misawa will receive from Kawada in this match. And just out of the corner of your eye, you can see Tawei, like, fuck Kobashi's leg into the barricade. Yeah, it's sort of incidental to the action, but it's still there.
You just see a flash of a boot. It's going by as it goes into the barricade. It's ridiculous. And I mean, it's a masterclass in how to put someone in a wheelchair. But
really is. Can I just sort of make a point at this juncture about how it's a funny thing. When I first watched this match, right, I was about 16 years old, I think, something like 17, maybe something like that. And at that point, the trend in what was considered to be good or excellent wrestling in the US had moved on to, it wasn't really flippy or anything like that, but it was real heavy work rate, kind of early ROH, when they were still in the sort of the gym hall kind of style, right? Which was great, because I love guys like Loki and Dragon and all those people. But actually, when you actually watch these matches, what's striking is that they're actually using, for the most part, very traditional wrestling move staples.
Yeah.
They modify a lot of stuff and they create a lot of stuff, but the base of it all is very much kind of like wrestling that I think, in a lot of ways, would be quite familiar to a US fan, certainly of of maybe the 70s, the 80s, in certain territories.
I think so. Like we said, wrestling isn't about the moves. Jerry Lawler can have an amazing match with just punches, the fist drop, and the power driver.
Yeah,
because it's not about what you do. I mean, this Kobashi versus Sasaki match that I mentioned earlier, they have a chop battle that, I'm not kidding when I say this, lasts 4.5 minutes. I timed it. It's just chops, and they tell a story with it. You know, there's an ebb and flow of who's on top. It's literally just the one move, and that could be a match in itself. It's absolutely fantastic. Now, having said that, you did say, it's quite standard moves. The head drops do begin.
Yes, around this time. Yeah, no, that's true.
They begin. Now, much as I love Misawa, his rear face lock is really bad. It never looks convincing as a move. And Kawada clearly knows because he...
Isn't it nice, though, that even Misawa, this man that we would look upon as for many people, the default number one wrestler spoken of in, tones reserved usually for sort of like gods, right? even he can just have a fucking nightmare on a holder once or twice, yeah. You know? Like, and yeah, you're right. It looked like fucking shit. Right.
So Kawada clearly knows that the crowd needs to be protected from this move because he just comes up to Misawa, grabs him from behind and gives him a backdrop driver right on his head. Now, at this point, if you're not familiar with Misawa, Misawa actually, Daniel's grimacing because he knows what I'm about to say. God. In 2009, Misawa passed away in the ring from virtually this exact move. The problem with the King's Road, and I think the major problem, is that we got this build-up of callbacks to previous matches and ever greater intensity. It was really a sort of arms race. You know, in one match, Misawa would get the pin after the first Tiger Driver. In another big match, someone would kick out and then it would take three Tiger Drivers and then people would be coming up with new finishers. Most famously, things like Kobashi's Burning Hammer, Kawada's Ganso Bomb, Misawa's Tiger Driver 91. And so the intensity of this of these matches really did ratchet up to unsustainable levels. By the time Misawa was really carrying Noah on his back as the company owner and top star in 2009, when business was really bad and he didn't think he could retire because the company needed him, you know, it wasn't as if the move in itself was more dangerous than any he'd taken. It was just the straw that broke the camel's back. So I think when we watch matches, it's something to bear in mind that, you know, I don't necessarily feel hugely squeamish watching these matches because firstly, they've happened. You know, there's nothing we can do is going to bring Misawa back. But also, and it's a cliche to say someone died doing what he loved, but Misawa, you know, chose to take all these moves and to take all these risks. You know, wrestling was really a craft for him. It was something that he ended up paying an incredibly high price for. But I think in a way, this is maybe a poor way of phrasing this, but it would almost be disrespectful to the sacrifices he made with his body not to watch these matches. I understand why people don't want to see Misawa getting dropped on his head, knowing that was exactly how his life ended. But
it's the same as like the hardcore championship matches when you watch them now. I mean, like the Daft Battle Royals, and they're talking about brain cells being scrambled and things like that.
Yeah,
it's very uncomfortable viewing, and it's like the Benoit argument that like, people don't watch Benoit matches; they just don't, you know, they just can't separate the two. But I think it's just a case of you need to, I mean, you know, obviously, these things, because people were so, you know, enthusiastic about it, and because the needs kept coming to make it better and better to the point where it became untenable, you know, it does have its cost, but, you know, in the process, they are incredible matches, and you are right in saying, you know, it would be disrespectful to then, you know, just totally ignore them, because then what, you know, what would the point of all the sacrifice have been if you're just not going to watch them?
Yeah, exactly. And so just something to bear in mind, I think, for our listeners, because we'll go back to Misawa and the King's Road, I'm sure, at a later date. So the match really builds to a wonderful crescendo. They do a fantastic job teasing Kenta Kobashi's moonsault, which in his early career was his main finisher, I think. And they do an amazing job teasing it. You know, he'll go up to the top rope and then Tawei will chokeslam him off or something like that. And when he does hit it, it gets an amazingly good near fall because they're built it up. And Kobashi, he's a big man. His athletic background was rugby. Amazingly graceful moonsault. Like, for the most part, he gets a lot of air on it. It looks fantastic.
I'm not really sure, other than a distinct lack of talent or application, what could possibly physically make him better at doing moonsaults than Lita ever was. But that's a thing, I think, which is just, you know, the guy shouldn't be able to do a moonsault that good.
No, it's like when you see someone like Chris Hero nowadays. Now, you know, Chris Hero, at the moment, current Chris Hero is a big fat bastard, but my God, it doesn't matter. He can still do all the moves that he could do it to, you know, anybody way. It's, you know, good on the lad.
It's better because he's fat.
It actually is, because I was having this conversation a couple of days ago. When he hits a strike, we're digressing massively now, when he hits a strike, there's so much heft behind it. Like, his strikes are absolute filth. But at the same time, when he does something like, you know, kipping up back to his feet when he's lying on his back or something like a moonsault, you think, Jesus Christ, fucking how did that big fat fucker do that?
Yeah.
It works on two levels. It really works for him. It's fantastic. Yeah. So anyway,
I'm sure we'll come back to issues of what wrestlers look like physically within this series because, the time period we're talking about now, these four guys don't look like wrestlers by today's standards, I don't think.
Oh, no, there's not a six-pack between them. You know, they are just... No. But actually, if I saw a guy... You know, I saw two guys coming up to try and do me harm, and one of them was, like, this glistening, chiseled Adonis, and one were, you know, looked like Kevin Owens or Kenta Kobashi, I would go for the glistening, chiseled Adonis every time and try and take him on because you think... You know, maybe that's all just for show. You look at someone like Kenta Kobashi, you think, Jesus Christ, he's a big, solid-looking bastard. And that's really traditionally the... you know, Vince McMahon has this idea that wrestlers should look like John Cena, and you can see every, you know, sculpted, veiny muscle on their bodies. The ideal tradition...
Striation!
Gary Stridham.
Wow!
The ideal traditionally in Japan has been very different. You know, people who look like... They play in the in the scrum in the rugby team. Someone like Kobashi and Misawa, they're athletes, but they are big solid looking guys at the end of the day.
Yeah, like even like an Ishii now, right?
Yeah,
like Ishii is just a little pit bull, right?
I mean, obviously, even by like 1999, when I've been watching the Vader Misawa match in 1999, Misawa looks so fucking old.
Oh,
like,
the belly on him, man.
Yeah,
he looks like you just think
And that's beer. That's not roids.
Oh yeah,
it probably is as well. But it's like that's mostly beer. That belly.
Oh yeah, like 1999. You hadn't moved on to sort of neckbeard Misawa. That was a different era.
Yeah, but he was just a really nice guy.
Yeah, there's actually I did hear a story. Misawa actually wrestled a show in Coventry in 2005.
That was a Noah. That was that Noah. Yeah, show, the
European this guy does, yeah. Channel Super Show, and they had a Noah match on it. And did hear a story that someone was waiting in the queue and this door opened to the side of them and it's Misawa popping out for a crafty fag. He hadn't realised that people were lining up to get in and Misawa just smiles at him and goes back indoors.
Before the smoking man, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, I mean, brilliant. Yeah, Misawa liked his booze, liked his fags. Anyway, back to the match once again. We're getting towards the end, believe me.
Well, I have a point to make about Kobashi in this match.
Go on, David.
I noticed that we were talking about Gira counting along, counting the time for that chop session. For the last good 5-10 minutes, Kobashi is never on his feet in this match.
No.
He's always down, and I love that.
Yeah,
his
work's amazing. His work is great while he's doing that. He's not standing up, but he's working.
No, there's a moment where I think is it Taui and Kawada, like they're stomping the shit out of Misawa on the floor, and Kobashi just like runs on top of him.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And, like, takes the beating.
All he can give is his body. It's like the raw emotion of it is absolutely fantastic.
And
I have
a very good. I genuinely believe that if I could get married again, Kobashi, I would be my best man, because there's no friends that can be as good a tag partner as Kobashi in this match. This is best man worthy.
You know what Sting needed back in the day, right? Sting needed a tag partner. This is what fucking Becky Lynch
fucking
needs now.
Sense. That's
this
what
is
he needed.
Can you imagine what happened next week when fucking they're that desperate? They've scraped the barrel. They've got Kurt Hawkins back. There's no one else. The fucking music comes on and they take a chance on a fucking 52-year-old Kenta Kobashi as Becky Lynch's tag partner.
I mean,
no one knows who it is in the audience.
I mean, he'd be in the top three workers of the year. Kobashi in NXT.
Yeah, no, but Kobashi in this is just. I mean, I think it's important for people to sort of know, and again, we'll cover this in more depth, but the fact that when Kobashi debuted, the guy didn't win a match for what, 100 matches?
72, I think, was the...
72. My bad. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd get the fuck out of here with your round estimates.
Yeah, fuck me. But, you know, like, that's crazy. And that is the kind of booking that makes these matches... Like, this is 20 years old now.
Yeah.
And this doesn't look a day out of place now. This could be on an NXT revival show, fucking, you know, or whatever. And people would go apeshit for it, right? American fans would go apeshit for this. I got no doubt if that amount of booking went into it.
Yeah.
You know?
It's literally years, because pushes in Japan, again, traditionally, tend to be quite glacial. it takes you, you know, like we said in Kabashi, 70 odd matches to even get your first win, and then you gradually work your way up the card. And I mean, Kawada, I think, didn't beat Misawa in their first 14 meetings, because and this is when Kawada for a lot of this time was the number two Japanese wrestler, but because Misawa was above him in the hierarchy, it took him so long for him to even get his first win. Like, it's always a really big thing if you beat someone who's booked, you know, above you, and you beat them for the first time. That was huge in All Japan, you know. Think about Jin Akiyama, how long it took him to a win over Misawa. I think 7 years from his debut.
Yeah.
But I think one of the great things about this match that we've said, not just Kobashi as well, but Misawa, the desperation of two guys who are really up against it and being absolutely beasted by the Holy Demon Army. There's chokeslams to the outside on Misawa from the apron, no less. That's a horrendous bump to be taking. And Misawa, you know, he fights against it for so long. He actually holds on to the rope as if he doesn't want to be cast into, you know, the pit beyond, until Kawada lariats him on the back of the head, and then Tai gives him the chokeslam. It's absolutely
on crazy. The back of the head as well. Yeah, like, it's inhumane. Like,
it's brutal, and
that's not legal in MMA.
Like we've said, Kobashi throws himself on Misawa's body post chokeslam. He also holds on to his leg to stop Kawada getting him up for the powerbomb.
Seriously, by this point, right? If you're religiously inclined, which I'm not, fair enough. But even I can see, like, the closest match that I've got to this is actually a lucha match. Which is Sangre Shikana versus MS1, which is one of the greatest lucha brawls of all time.
You mentioned that match a lot.
Yes, I do.
I've to get round to watching it, it is on my watch list.
Yeah, same. I mean, I'm not going to go on about it too much because this isn't a lucha podcast, but there is a level of kind of this weird combination of ecstasy, catharsis, like, you know, a total catharsis combined with just brutality. Which I think this match reminds me of in some ways, actually.
Yeah, I mean, something I would compare that to is there's another All Japan match actually, 1996 World's Strongest Tag League Final, which was again the Holy Demon Army versus Misawa and Jin Akiyama instead of Kobashi. Amazing match, but I'm trying to remember what the spot is that Akiyama takes. I think it's the chokeslam off the apron to the outside, I think. And he takes that about 15, 20 minutes into the match. And to all intents and purposes, Jin Akiyama is dead for the rest of that match. Yeah. He can't do anything. About the last 10 minutes of the match is Misawa and Tawa and Kawada double teaming Misawa. And there's a couple of occasions at which Akiyama can muster just enough strength within himself to break up the pin. But, you know, he can't do it. And that's the same as in this match. Kobashi, his legs don't work.
No.
They're knackered. All he can do is put his body in between the men who are trying to do his friend harm. And I think, and this is what we were saying earlier about stories being told purely through the action in the ring. You cannot speak a word of Japanese, I barely do. And you can really sense the bond between these two wrestlers, the merciless, you know, the merciless heelery of the Holy Demon Army. I mean, the finish is literally Kawada does all the finishes to Misawa. He powerbombs him so many times while Tao is just there stopping Kobashi from crawling over. And you get the sense that even if Tao wasn't there to block him, Kobashi probably wouldn't make it.
It finishes like a great history painting. It seriously does. Yeah. You could take a snapshot of that at the end with Kobashi just grabbing it. It's beautiful stuff. As I say, I think it's the great. It's certainly the greatest. I think the greatest tag team match of all time.
Yeah, no question. For me, no, it's my favorite there. Match. Now, one of the things we wanted to talk about is that, is this particularly? I know this was my first Puroresu match, but is this a good one for someone to start with? Because, you know, like we've said about the context, it's also 43 minutes long. It's a bit of an epic. Is this like something that's quite jarring for a first time viewer, or can you just enjoy it in isolation? You know, do you need to know all this stuff that's gone into it? As much as we've talked about the context, can you just enjoy the action for what it is?
I think you can. I think it very much depends on your mindset, and I think people have different mindsets when they approach things like this, and neither one's right and neither one's wrong. It's just a different approach to things. Some people might, I don't know, for example, be already kind of quite cool with the notion that there's no English commentary, for example.
Yeah.
You might be someone who watches a lot of films in different languages or whatever and reads subtitles. You might be someone who listens to music that's in a different language. You know, you might already have that little bit of experience with being able to deal with a performance that isn't delivered exclusively in English. But because pro wrestling commentary in particular, in getting over the motivations, when it's good, it should be. I'm talking Lance Russell and Gordon Soley here, and perhaps not some more contemporary figures. Corey Graves, stuff like that. But, you know, it's really important to getting stuff over. And I think sometimes if you're lacking that, and I remember I showed this to our good friend, the mysterious Gary, who will probably be mentioned on this podcast again, a few years ago, before he'd really gotten into Japanese wrestling. And he said that it was just like watching a different world to him. The first thing he asked me when the match started was, who's the heel and who's the face? Which isn't actually, as much as we might have talked about the dastardly tactics involved in this match, isn't actually as easy a question to answer.
Yeah, I've used the term heel, but really, I mean, it's less about that and more about, I think, the intensity of the roles in the psychology. You know, the dominant tag team are the one who's really under the cosh.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So it's not easy to identify a sort of stereotypical heel and face right away. When the match first started, Gary, you know, because they're sort of going through a few holds and things, there's a few strikes done, there's a kind of testing out period, and Gary was sort of saying to me, oh right, well I can see that obviously you know, you must be more into wrestling these days for kind of the physical aspect of it, the actual wrestling itself. And I kind of thought, well that's weird, because to me this is the most emotional, like, you know, sort of over the top almost in some ways match I've ever seen. So I do think that there are barriers to it, and I think perhaps these days, given the fact that, you know, New Japan is on American television, for God's sake, you know, Jim Ross is commentating on Wrestle Kingdom. New Japan has grown so much in the last few years that I think that in some ways certain people that don't want to jump straight into it, there's nothing wrong, I think, with jumping into a little bit of stuff that's maybe more contemporary. You might have seen some of these guys work the Indies or Ring of Honor or whatever, and you want to watch that first. That's totally cool.
Yeah.
But I think that it stands alone in terms of its narrative. And I think that you can just dip into this, and after the first couple of minutes, once you've acclimatized to it, I think it's just such a great match that you can watch it.
Yeah, I mean, this was my first match, and like I say, I absolutely loved it. I had no idea who any of these people were, but I just the emotion and the psychology of it. And I think, and this might be one of the last things to talk about, because we've got two more matches to consider, but I think this provides a bit of a rejoinder to some of the stereotypes of that Japanese wrestling is all about no selling,
which is complete nonsense.
It is, yeah.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I mean, what we have are, there are parts where, again, I've talked about this idea of Tukon, fighting spirit, fighting through the pain. But so you have bits where someone will get chopped and then, you know, they'll pop up and do a move and collapse. But, and I've seen those sort of spots done so badly in other matches. The great thing about these guys is that they always work them in at the proper point. You know, you have this last gasp, desperation move before a wrestler collapses, things like that, and Misawa will have this absolute onslaught of elbow strikes against someone. Kawada will pop back with some of his kicks, but you never feel as though it's excessive. You know, you never feel as though there isn't going to be selling somewhere down the line. And Kobashi in this match is, I think, the exemplar of this. Much as, you know, he, out of a lot of these guys, probably most out of all of them, has a reputation for no selling. I think that reputation is undeserved, really.
I would personally go out on the limb here and say that this is the best selling performance I've ever seen in any match.
Without
a shadow of a doubt.
It's definitely up there. I would say that I always kind of thought that the book on Kobashi's selling was more that he oversold than that he didn't sell, if that makes sense. And some people pinpoint this match as being the, you know, with the whole messianic sort of spots and things, they pinpoint this as the match where Kobashi begins to be prone to too much overselling. Mm. I think that's kind of bullshit, because Kobashi is essentially a cartoon kind of babyface hero that you know, that doesn't really bother me. But yeah, so there's that to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, obviously, there is like matches that have like no selling. Like, for example, I was listening to a podcast where talking about, you know, the promotion Bassara.
Yeah.
They had a match recently where somebody got hit with some ridiculous move, like a head drop suplex or something like that, and he kicked out at zero. And then he did it again, and he kicked out at zero again. And I was like, fucking hell, like,
Jesus
two
Christ.
Two kicks out at zero. I don't think I've ever seen a proper kick out at zero. It's usually always one, but two. In consecutive fashion, 2-0 kick outs. That's Jesus bad Christ. No selling.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you think you know no selling. Watch Basala. Yeah,
well, I'll come to no selling in a bit when we get to my match, but the one thing that I mentioned earlier about my friend who's going on a honeymoon to Japan at the moment. Well, before he got married, the day before, I thought, we're kind of acquaintances, so I thought I'll give him a wedding gift. So I gave him this match to watch.
And what, you just sent him a link?
You know, yeah, just, you know, some people say that the day you get married is the day you turn into a man. I think that's absolute shite, and it's clearly the day you watch this match is the day that you turn into a man.
Totally, man.
Okay, well.
What? Last night of freedom, watching, you know, Misawa, Kobashi, Kawada, and Taui.
Springsteen's written entire albums about watching Kobashi and, like.
Oh my god! So we're not gonna do star ratings on this podcast. You can probably guess what mine would be for this match if I was going to. But I think you know what? If you just rely on your star ratings to get, I'm getting on my soapbox here. But if you just rely on the star rating, like the number, that doesn't really give you the essence of what wrestling is, you know. Watch the match, read the review, listen to the podcast.
Person here says, back in the 90s, Bret Hart bought a mansion in America from Monty Burns. Did he ever sell it back to him?
I thought his mansion was in Calgary.
I never heard that story, so I thought I would ask
he,
you.
I know that Bret had a giant. I don't remember him ever living in the United States, you know, until, I know he's got the place in Hawaii now, but that's after he retired in Kona, but, I don't remember him ever living outside of Calgary. He built a huge house in Calgary. I think this was in the late 80s even, maybe early 90s. It was before he was like a big star, because I remember because Bret Hart was always pretty frugal when it came to money. Well, you know, his nickname was the Frugal Canadian, so he was pretty frugal when it came to money, which is a good trait. And then he bought the big house, and people were going like, God, he's going to have to wrestle until he's, you know, 50 to pay off that big house. And as it turned out, you know, he ended up making a lot more money than anyone ever imagined he would make in wrestling. But, I don't know, unless maybe he bought a house and then sold it, but he never lived in it. But I never remember him living anywhere but Calgary during his active career.
All right, go ahead. We'll do one more each.
Okay.
Sing of the rise.